You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today there's a better way.
Hello, this is Rod Adams, and it's time for Atomic Show number 130. Tonight I have with me Charles Barton and Kirk Sorensen, both of whom blog at Energy from Thorium, and we're going to discuss a variety of topics. So here we go. Jumping right into the chat. Okay, recorder's on. So go ahead, Charles. We're talking about the impressive showing that nuclear power has been having in polls recently, specifically a 59% approval rating from Gallup, and then Charles was going to go on.
Well, my observation is just that we've won the war as far as public relations is concerned. We've won it by staying on message, basing what we have to say on facts rather than appealing to emotion.
Well, there's nothing wrong with emotion, and quite honestly, Charles, although I love optimism, I do not believe the battle is yet won.
Yeah, I would agree with Rod there. A paradigm I was thinking about it the other day in terms of, you learn statistics, you know, there's sort of your one sigma, there's your two sigma, and there's your three sigma. You know, three sigma is something like 99% of people. I feel like with nuclear now, we've got one sigma of the population, you know, 66% or so saying they like it. Now, what's the two sigma answer to getting, you know, another 25% or so of the population to be on board? And then you've got your, you know, six or seven sigmas out there that, you know, no matter what you tell them, they'll never change their mind. You know, they're the ones who will, you know, dead end on the blogs and the discussion forums, just, you know, hating nuclear power till the bitter end. But the fact that we are winning in the sense that a significant majority of Americans support nuclear power, and then with the knowledge we have that there are even better ways to do nuclear power that can continue to build more and more public support for nuclear power, you know, answering the questions and the concerns that keep a whole additional group of people from supporting nuclear power. And that's what I think, you know, there's light water reactors have got one sigma, and with better reactors we can get more.
Well, we're getting more and more attention to alternative nuclear power, the thorium.
And certainly with this decision by the president to change course on Yucca Mountain, that's going to call a lot of the questions that we've been discussing into sharp relief. You know, I know that all three of us in this discussion have certainly not been pro Yucca Mountain, probably for different reasons than the president or Senator Reid. But nevertheless, you know, that question, which I think the nuclear industry 3 or 4 years ago would have considered, you know, answered and solved, is now up for discussion again, and we're going to be able to see a public discussion of, you know, why are we throwing away spent nuclear fuel that has a great deal of value in it?
Well, you know, one of the things that people have said about Harry Reid is they believe that he's somehow anti-nuclear, but didn't he even advance a bill in support of thorium not too long ago?
Yeah, he was a co-sponsor on Hatch's bill, Thorium Energy Independence Act of 2008, which is did not progress past committee and is, you know, not active in the current Congress. But it's interesting that he was a supporter of that bill with Hatch.
I mean, when you look at it from a political point of view, there's real strong reasons why a senator from, you know, the tiny little state, at least population-wise, of Nevada, feels like it was a huge victory to tell the country, hey, don't dump your waste on us. If you don't want it, we don't want it. You know, it just, to me, the from a purely political point of view, when the country got together, and it seemed like they almost ganged up on Nevada and said, hey, let Mikey do it, you know?
Yeah, and that's, I think the Yucca Mountain decision that was made recently was a case of the right decision being made for the wrong reasons. Yucca Mountain, I don't think, is a good idea in the sense of continuing this once-through fuel cycle and throwing away large amounts of spent nuclear fuel with lots of valuable things in it, not just the actinides and the transuranics, but also the fission products. Now, they're locked up in a matrix that's more difficult to reprocess. You know, obviously, the uranium oxide fuels, we chose it because it's so darn chemically stable in the reactor. Well, that also makes it harder to reprocess. But nevertheless, you know, there's a lot of valuable things, even among the fission products, which are generally even, most people think of them as like the real waste, the real throwaway. I'm like, well, you know, there's a lot of good stuff there, too, even. I really think we're going to
see
a future.
Have you seen the market price of xenon recently?
No, has it gone up?
Now, the market price of xenon is several thousand dollars per ounce. It's
pretty
incredible.
So, yeah, I mean, we've got a – it's a case where we're going to end up someday being able to sell everything but the – what do they say when they sell pigs? Sell everything but the oink, you know. We're going to be able to go
everything
through there.
Everything but the squeal, everything but the moo.
Everything squeal, there you go. I'm sorry.
That's definitely the future. Either the liquid fluoride thorium reactor or with the fast liquid metal reactors, you will be producing increasingly rare materials as byproducts.
Well, also the possibility, and this is one of the things I've been thinking a lot about lately, is using the reprocessing techniques that were developed for other reactors, not the Purex schemes, but, you know, things that were developed for things like IFR and LIFTR to reprocess existing spent nuclear fuel. I'm particularly interested in taking spent nuclear fuel and fluorinating it, extracting the uranium as UF6, just like we do from uranium ore, and getting that, you know, 97% or so of the spent nuclear fuel out as UF6, and then using fluoride chemistry to separate other things in there from one another, because the fluoride chemistry technology went pretty far, and I've been doing a lot of reading lately and finding your father's name all over the place in my research, Charles. He did some amazing work on the chemistry of not only actinide fluorides, fission product fluorides, all kinds of these things, and it's a very nice state to work with spent nuclear fuel in, because you can do some straightforward separation technologies.
You know, and it's really sad, Charles, because, you know, if your father hadn't worked so much with all that radioactive material, he may have lived to be 110 instead of just 97.
Well, you know, on your discussion of the benefits of low-level radiation, you know, lots of the scientists in Oak Ridge lived into their 80s and even a few into their 90s, like my father.
Yeah. Well, I chatted with Glenn Seaborg at ANS meetings when he was in his late 80s, maybe early 90s, and I think I once tried to capture just how many of the pioneers have lived to be a very ripe old age. You know, one of my good friends, Ted Rockwell, is, I think, about 88 right now.
Yeah, and that's a very important message, I think, to get across to the public. And I was really glad to see that post on your blog about that, Rod, about the Hormesis study, because a powerful message that the anti-nuclear people use is that radiation is evil, and it is poisonous, and it is artificial, and it is unnatural, and it will kill you, and it will mutate you into some horrible thing. And then when you talk to people and you say, guess what? You live around radiation all the time. You're breathing radon gas right now. Your body has potassium 40 and carbon 14 and all manner of radioactive isotopes in the environment. It's in the dirt. It's in the ground. And guess what? Your body knows how to repair radiation damage. It does it all the time. It does it from radiation from the sun. It does it from ionizing radiation from radioisotopes. And not only does it know how to do that, we're finding more and more that that may be a very good thing for your body. Analogous to how exercise makes you stronger, that those repair mechanisms are also, when stimulated, leading you to greater health and longevity. And when people start getting that message and going, oh, wait a minute, you mean radiation's all over the place anyway, and it's not killing me, and it's perhaps making me better? Yeah, wow, that's amazing. You know,
well,
that's a real paradigm shift in their mind.
Right, and it's really important for people to understand just how wide a variation that natural level is around the world, and how the studies have shown that people who live all their lives in areas with very high background radiation, tens of times larger than the average. And in fact, I think there's places in Iran, for example, where the background is somewhere around 8 rem.
And that is really interesting, because when I was studying this idea of the linear no threshold, and for listeners who don't know what this is, it's the assumption that any level of radiation will cause death and damage in the body. And even though it's a very small percentage, when you multiply by billions of people, you go and say, oh, 600 people will get cancer if you release this, you know, fraction of a millirem of radioactive gas. Well, one of the things that bothered me is I thought, we can't ever disprove this, because we can't ethically, according to the parameters of this theory, we can't ethically go out and expose a whole group of people to, you know, half a rem or to 2 rems or to 3 rems and see what happens, because that would just be considered unethical. But then what we find out is nature's doing this for us. There are places in the world where people are getting, you know, like you said, 8 rems. I mean, that's about, you know, that's roughly 16 to 20 times the background level of radiation. So then you go, okay, nature's running this experiment for us. Let's go in this population. Let's see, are people getting 20 times the cancer rate that they're getting in normal places? Are we going to see this? And what do we find? No.
Well, we've also run a few accidental experiments. I think there was a apartment complex in Taiwan, I believe, that somehow the...
There was some cobalt 60 mixed with steel.
Right. They had some recycled steel in the apartment complex, and they figured out, you know, after the people had lived there for, I don't know, 20 years, that the background radiations were quite high from this recycled steel.
But to the average person, that's terrifying to them. I mean, you tell them you're living and you're being irradiated, and they think, oh, nothing could be worse, you know, and you have to help them understand that compared to what nature's giving you anyway, it's just not a big deal.
Well, all of the Cold War and World War II nuclear sites have extremely high levels of radiation from environmental contaminants. What has been found consistently in demographic studies is that the populations that are exposed to these contaminated areas are not getting excessive cancer, are not having unusual health problems, and probably have on average longer lifespans.
Yeah, there will always be people, though, like Mangano or whatever his name is, Joseph, the tooth fairy dude.
Well, that gives them attention and notoriety. I mean, it fulfills the need for them. Yeah.
Right. And they can point to the single studies, just like the Storm Smith studies about the energy input into uranium mining, which is the only one that is out there that says anything about how the energy input is a big issue. And, of course, it's the one that gets quoted all the time by the antis. But the only way to fight that is to do what Jerry Cutler and Myron Polykov did and do a real science-based study, you know, publish it in reputable journals, get it peer-reviewed, and then try to spread the word that it really exists. And so that's, I hope that, you know, other people pick up that link that I posted on Atomic Insights and share that widely. Get people to read the things, you know. Let them use their own questioning attitude and say, hey, what is this really showing us? Does this make sense to me? Can I look at that bottle of aspirin on my shelf and realize, you know, that bottle has 500 aspirin. If I eat all 500, I probably will die. But if 500 people eat one aspirin, nobody will die. And certainly if 1,000 people eat a half an aspirin, you know, you're still not going to get one death, right?
And that is the fallacy of the linear no-threshold hypothesis. But people generally assume that that is a conservative approach, that let's be extra safe and let's assume this, when the reality is by making that assumption, we are penalizing nuclear power unfairly and inadvertently contributing to more health problems through the burning of coal. And that is just, you know, the law of unintended consequences. We certainly see it economically in our country, but here it is radiologically. We think that, you know, as Charles Hermy says, you know, to paraphrase the Bible, we strain at a millirem and then we swallow a gigaton. You know, it just
well,
doesn't make any sense.
Of course, it's the law of intended consequences because there's lots of folks that want us to be afraid of radiation so they can sell more coal. But
yeah,
that's another story. Well, I did want to talk to you guys a little bit about, have you had a chance to do any reading or review the speech that President Obama gave today at in the Czech Republic?
I saw it briefly on the evening news, and yeah, let's talk about it.
Yeah, well, for those listeners who haven't kept up today on in a speech in Prague in the Czech Republic, President Obama laid out a plan, or he laid out a goal to actually follow through on the non-proliferation treaty, which was signed, well, I don't know, 1972 maybe, and all nations who signed that treaty agreed that those countries with nuclear weapons would work to eliminate them, and those countries that did not have nuclear weapons would agree not to try to build them. So he said, you know, this is the deal, and it's a logical deal, and we really will work towards a goal of no nuclear weapons on the planet. But, of course, he also, you know, said that there was some steps along the way, and he thought it may not even be within his own lifetime.
Well, you know, one of the things we can talk about is the surplus of weapons-grade U-235 and plutonium-239 that we keep in stockpiles just in case we want to build enough weapons to destroy China and the Soviet and Russia 10 times over. We have actually a great surplus of warheads now, again in stockpiles, so we could probably afford to dispose of 90% of our U-235 and plutonium-239 without diminishing our deterrent, nuclear deterrent.
Yeah, and this is where I sympathize with the overall goal of the speech, but some of the specifics I think I take a little bit of issue about. I don't think it would be a good idea for the United States to eliminate all of its nuclear weapons. I think it would be a good idea for the United States to eliminate most of its nuclear weapons. But to be in a situation where we have absolutely none at all, I think invites us to be at a strategic disadvantage to any nation that would violate the treaty and develop even one. They could literally put us in a very compromised position by that at all.
One of the things that I've concluded in my looking at the proliferation issues is that it is actually very easy for small countries to acquire nuclear weapons. The technology is out there. All you have to do is put out feelers, and for a modest amount of money, maybe $50 million or $100 million, you can get the detailed plans, and for a few $100 million, you can start producing your fissionable materials and build simple weapons.
Well, I tend to disagree. I think that it's significantly more difficult than people make it out to be to actually follow through and build a deliverable weapon.
It's one thing
to build an explosive. It is another thing to build a weapon that can be actually delivered. And,
like on an ICBM?
Right.
Yeah,
well,
I mean, something that lightweight is going to be much more difficult.
Even carry it in an airplane. I mean,
yeah.
You guys remember just how big the B-29 was. And those weapons that were delivered with the, you know, that were relatively easy to construct during World War II, although they took, you know, a whole nation 4 years to put together, you know, they were as big as the plane could deliver.
Well, let me back up, Rod. You'd asked the question initially, what do you think of the goal of going to no nuclear weapons worldwide?
Well, I don't think that a world without nuclear weapons would be any safer than a world with nuclear weapons. Now, the one challenge that I have from an intellectual point of view, and I'm not suggesting a policy here, what I'm saying from an intellectual point of view is, suppose I was born in a country like Switzerland or Liechtenstein or Morocco or South Africa, or, you know, pick a country. Why do the countries that just happen to get there first feel they have a right to continue to own nuclear weapons and to prevent the rest of us from saying, you know, I just want to have one, just in case somebody decides they're going to try to attack me. I want to have, you know, something in my quiver that says, you know, I don't think that's a good idea. Leave me alone.
Well, you put your finger right on it, which is kind of the nonsensical nature of the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty. If right. nuclear weapons are unethical, and, you know, there's a very good argument that they are, then why does any country get them? You know, why do the first five they got there supposedly, why are they grandfathered in like a old coal plant? Now, I am not arguing for other countries to have nuclear weapons. That is certainly not what I want. But I'm saying that it doesn't really hold together if you think about it for a minute. You know, why is that all right? The other part of that, too, is, and you began to put your finger on it, most countries that want nuclear weapons do not want them in order to use them. They want them to protect their regime. It's the whole idea that I know that, you know, if you're Kim Jong-il, you're thinking, okay, the United States could nuke me to kingdom come, but if I can threaten them by getting one off and getting one of their cities, they're not going to attack me. They're not going to give up one of their cities for the benefit of you know, flattening my country. And it is that idea of regime protection that I think is at the heart of most renegade countries' desire for nuclear weapons. Now, there are a few, on the other hand, that I think very much want them to use them. And there's one in particular, I think, that if they get nuclear weapons, will actually use them. But I think most countries, and this would include even countries that are friendly to the United States, like Israel, have them kind of as this mechanism of last resort in order to protect the country at the very last stages of potentially being overrun.
I'm sympathetic with India, because India is basically almost surrounded by two nuclear powers, China and Pakistan. And it is in their strategic interest, because particularly Pakistan has a long history of hostility towards India, and China and India have fought some border skirmishes. It's in the Indian interest to possess some atomic weapons.
And they do.
And they do. And there's another angle to this as well, which is we are terrified with the use of atomic weapons, as we should be. They are horrible, horrible mechanisms of destruction. But as such, if we can avoid using them against each other, we may someday look back and say, this horrible weapon was the device that sobered us up as a people, as a civilization, made us realize that war could not be fought for limited and inconsequential items. It was literally, you know, you fight for all or nothing. And I mean this between the superpowers. You look at the first 50 years of the 20th century, blood and war. You look at the last 50 years of the 20th century, fairly peaceful in comparison to the first 50 years. What was the difference? Once nuclear weapons were in possession of the great superpowers, all of a sudden there was no in between, there was no little wars. There was all or nothing, baby, you know. And you generally said, no, I don't want to fight at all. Let's just not fight.
Right.
And we didn't.
And one of the things, I believe that human nature is pretty universal. And although there are places where there are leaders who can convince folks to go out and risk their own lives and either through suicide bombers or special forces or whatever, and go off and fight war someplace else. What nuclear weaponry did was it put the leaders and their families at risk.
Yep.
And that suddenly caused them to behave a little more human.
Right.
They became much more self-protective. And I think that's not a bad thing. I don't like the idea of having elite rulers who can send off their young people to battle and, you know, get the glory of, you know, having led their country to victory and, of course, ignore all the blood and the guts and the flag draped coffins and stuff that come back. To me, that I don't know. I'm not terribly opposed. But going back to, you know, the idea of getting rid of, you know, right now there's 26,000 already assembled warheads in the world, and I believe that 96% of those are owned by two countries.
Right.
It is worthwhile to reduce those numbers.
Oh, absolutely.
Partially because there's so much valuable material available if you start getting rid of some of that stockpile.
Well, Alvin Weinberg argued for 100 nuclear warheads on each side, and I think he's right. I think it's about how many.
Because how much fissile material would we need to jumpstart a lifter or pebble bed modular reactor type economy?
Well, it would be a lot less with the lifter because the pebble bed would require continued infusion of fissile material. But on the lifter case,
not
we
necessarily.
We need the start charges. And with the highly enriched uranium that is currently available today, we could get going about 1 to 2,000 gigawatts of power, and then that would be sustained essentially indefinitely by thorium after that. That's what's so impressive about this fissile material. If we can utilize it in reactors like Lifter, is it essentially means unlimited power,
right?
Versus the approach we have today, which is, you know, the megatons to megawatts, the downblending. It's the difference between eating your corn or planting your corn. You know, you plant your corn and you'll have corn from then on. But you eat your corn and you'll be full once, and that's why on my blog and with Charles I've opposed the idea of downblending the highly enriched uranium. I said we should keep this not for weapons but for use in reactors that can use it efficiently, not once but use it as a seed to catalyze, so to speak,
right,
the consumption of energy from then on.
Yeah.
And I think that's there's nothing more swords to plowshares I can think of than that.
Yeah, but of course, don't forget that Lifter's not the only way that you can do that. The thorium light water reactor proves that you could produce as much fuel as you're using. And they did that with a reactor that was simply just a new core and an old light water reactor.
Yes, and what we are talking about there is we're talking about reactors that have a conversion ratio of at least one. You know, that's the
right
salient difference there. And that would also have to include sustaining that conversion ratio through a reprocessing process. And that's sort of my main concern with the light water breeder reactor technology, is that when you go and try to reprocess thorium oxide, it's a real bear. You know, it makes reprocessing uranium oxide feel like a piece of cake in comparison, because it's just so darn chemically stable. So to really hit that breeding ratio of one, well, the other option is the fast breeder, but then with the fast breeder, now all of the depleted uranium now becomes a candidate for conversion to very attractive weapons grade material. And
which is great, since we have 500,000 tons sitting in stockpile right now
of UF6. Yeah, it's really hard to see how we're ever going to burn down all the UF6. I was just reading today about using depleted uranium in concrete. Somebody posted something on the forum about that. I thought that was kind of interesting. This would be using it as a depleted uranium concrete shield for spent fuel casks, and I guess it has some very attractive properties that way. But we're certainly in no danger of running out of uranium. We've got lots and lots and lots.
No, depleted uranium is a great shield. I think it's a great shield that happens to be a blanket and, you know, et cetera.
The Indians have apparently developed a low-cost liquid metal fast breeder technology, and they can burn the U-238.
Well, that would be interesting to kind of peer under the hood with that, because if they did that, then they've done something that no other major powers ever pulled off, which was figuring out how to make the liquid metal fast breeder reactor economically feasible.
Well, they claim that they can build it for $1.4 billion for a 1 gig.
Now, is that based on Indian labor rates?
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Well, then that would be the salient difference there. Indian regulatory environment as well?
Yeah. Okay. Well, actually, the Indians are pretty safety conscious. Their coal mines, for example, are much safer than the Chinese coal mines.
Well, I didn't mean that as a besmirchment of the Indian safety culture. What I'm saying is any safety culture is going to assume that any other one is not up to their specs. So even if the Indian safety culture is superior to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the NRC is going to want to completely redo everything themselves.
Oh, of course. We're not going to get Indian technology here. Gives India long-term economic advantage if they can produce breeder reactors for $1.4 billion.
Yeah, whoever can get this technology in a buildable place first is going to have a profound advantage over other nations. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah,
the Indians have done it. That's
I'm kind of a fan of the some of the Chinese developments. Although I would much prefer for them to be being done here, as I've talked a little bit to Charles when we were waiting for you to finish whatever it was you were doing at 7:30 Eastern time. But the Chinese have an operating pebble bed reactor and are building a couple of more that will be hooked up to steam plants. Now, the Chinese also have a huge inventory of coal-burning power plants hooked to steam plants, where if you have high temperature pebble beds and you want to start making zero emission plants from your nasty burning coal plants, it's a heck of a lot easier to simply replace the boilers and get rid of all the coal handling equipment than it is to try to put a chemical plant on the back end and somehow maybe possibly scrub the CO2 and leave all the other noxious stuff and pump it and bury it.
This actually lowers your cost because you're recycling part of the coal-fired plant.
And, of course, there's no reason why it couldn't be some other reactor, although to be able to meld up with an existing coal plant, you have to have a certain level of temperature.
Right.
Because they're not designed to run at low temperature steam there.
And for that temperature regime, the pebble bed is almost certainly.
Oh, Charles, you still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Somehow I lost Kirk. Let me
yep,
see if I can
do.
Get him back in.
Okay, go ahead.
He just disappeared.
Maybe the aliens kidnapped him.
Either that or maybe he's on a battery powered phone. Trying dialing it back in again.
Okay. Hello?
Hey, Kirk, you there?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure what happened all of a sudden.
All of a sudden, you just disappeared.
Yeah, okay.
But anyway, so we're back, and Charles was talking about the lowering the capital cost of reactor technology by, you know, recycling existing steam plants.
I've looked at this for liquid fluoride thorium reactors,
And there's a case that can be made for at least using the sites and using the buildings on the sites. Probably not a strong case for recycling the steam turbines.
And I agree with that. I think it's a very interesting possibility because of the nature of the sites. You know, they already have abundant sources of cooling water. They're already got the transmission grids hooked in right into that spot. There's a workforce that's been working and participating in that plant. There's probably large power-consuming industries that have located nearby to take advantage of low-cost power. I think it's a very good idea.
You know, one of the things that I also think about with the lifter technology is not so much that, you know, we're going to stop building light water reactors and all go to lifter, but what it does do is it provides a path for the future for all of the used materials that we've been so worried about,
right,
from light water reactors. You know, that all the stuff that we're storing up is could be, like you said, with the fluoridation chemistry and a few other things, made readily available as we build the infrastructure that will be necessary to build something like the liquid thorium thermal reactors.
Yeah, and there's even ways to do that within our lifter paradigm, especially now that we're looking so strongly at the two-fluid version of lifter, because you can imagine a core fluid where you're kind of just dumping this transuranic stuff that you want to burn up, and then having the blanket of thorium that's capturing the neutrons from that. And those reactors, these particular versions of lifter, may not even be hitting the conversion ratio of one. What you may be doing essentially is just converting plutonium and americium and the other stuff into U-233 functionally by just continually taking out the blanket and starting up other clean lifters on U-233, and then just sort of feeding either HEU or TRUs into the core fluid. There's a really big advantage to that approach, and that is when you contrast it with the approach of making MOX fuel. One of the real hard things about making MOX is getting the isotopic concentrations just the way you want them to be, you know, because you've got this feed coming in of different burn-ups, you know, ever so slightly different burn-ups, so different fuel units and so forth. And then you've got to go and you've got to take this stream of plutonium and you've got to go make a fuel form. And unfortunately, the fuel form you make is almost always a little different because not every single fuel element and every single light water reactor got burned just the same way. You know, they all kind of got burned a little different. And that makes it more difficult when you then go and fabricate these solid fuel MOX elements and go put them in a reactor to burn them, is that you're potentially rerunning all of your neutronics and all of your safety and all of your criticality, you know, by each batch of MOX you put in. In fact, maybe even down to each element, not knowing really what is the composition of these elements to the degree we need to know. With lifter, on the other hand, you can almost adjust the concentration of the fluid online. And I sort of, the picture in my mind is of the chemist working in his laboratory, you know, adding drip, drip, drip just a little bit more to the solution to make it just right. That's one of the things you can do with a fluid-fueled reactor, is if your concentrations aren't quite right, well, you can add a little more. If there's too much, you can dilute it or take a little bit away. It's not an option in a solid-fueled reactor.
Well, there's a different option in a solid-fuel reactor.
I mean, solid-fuel,
exactly. What's wrong with moving absorbers around? What's wrong with moving, you know, portions of the core to change the...
It's more expensive.
Not necessarily.
Well, I mean, yes, it is, Rod.
No,
it's more expensive to have.
I think of
control rods than to not have them, and it's more expensive to have a system where you're adding borium to the coolant water.
I've never used boron.
Well, yeah, and you're a Navy guy. You haven't used boron, but we've got a fellow on the forum who's a reactor operator at San Onofre in California, and he's a guy that runs the reactor there day in and day out. And one of the things that I learned from talking to him is when you're running a big power reactor, is you spend a lot of time Well, hopefully if you do it right, you don't spend a lot of time doing this. But if you get it wrong, you spend a lot of time chasing xenon around the core, because what you do is you end up setting up a little bit too hard of a burn in one side, which builds up more xenon, and then that depresses the burn later on in that part of the core and pushes it off to another part of the core. And so you're continually moving these rods around, trying to keep a nice flat profile of burn across the core. And he says it's, you know, if you get it, if it starts getting a little out of hand, it's non-trivial to kind of damp it back down again, because it's an effect that has, you know, like the 9-hour half-life of xenon. Now, I'm imagining a big PWR all loaded up with MOX fuel elements, and all those MOXes are just a little bit different from each other, you know. It would be really hard for an operator, potentially, to keep that core burning nice and uniformly with a bunch of fuel elements that just aren't all quite like each other. So,
there's no doubt that there's going to be, that there are operational challenges, but some of our paradigms, you know, I like to think of operating the heating element in a reactor as a little bit like, you know, operating a fire. You know, you got to be able to play a little bit with the kindling and the size of the log, and you move things around, and if you have the proper control, it's not that hard. And
well, it is kind of like a fire, but it's like a fire that you only get to, you know, singe the fuel on just a little bit, at least in a solid core reactor. It's funny you made the analogy. I thought the same thing, but I sort of imagined building the log cabin fire like I did when I was a scout. And then you get it going, and it burns just a little bit, and then you go pour water on it and take it all out and try to scrape the ash off the face of the wood, and then go build it all up again. That would be sort of the parallel of what we do with solid fuel.
That's what we do with existing light water reactors.
That's right.
Not what you have to do because it's solid fuel. It has nothing to do with the fact it's solid fuel.
You're thinking of pebbles then, right?
It doesn't. There's other ways to do it. Pebbles. I know of solid fuel reactors that burn up 60% of the installed material, not just two or three.
Well, naval reactors, yeah.
I'm not talking about any particular reactors. I'm talking about there are reactors that can do it. You don't. It's not just, you know, it was a choice, a design choice that was made for the large light water reactors. It makes economic sense, mainly for the fuel suppliers, but it makes economic sense the way we do it. But it's not the only way the technology can work.
Yeah, well, I mean, the advantage I see to the liquid fuel paradigm is that continuous core homogenization. As you know, whatever you've got, it's always going to be the same throughout the core. And if there is a differential burn-up in one part or another, it's going to be homogenized on every fuel pass. That's a very, very, very nice feature to have when you're dealing with fuel streams of uncertain isotopic concentration, like you would get from recycling spent nuclear fuel from light water reactors. So going back to the original point, I think this makes a lot. And I think you're in agreement with me because you brought this up in the first place.
No, I'm in full agreement.
This makes a lot of sense for this.
There's a lot of synergies involved in using the type of technology that you and Charles are advocating for. But the thing that I try to remind both of you, because I don't think either one of you has a manufacturing environment, is that there's a tremendous amount of benefit from continuing to build what we know how to build today, and to use the people that are very knowledgeable about operating light water reactors to continue doing that, producing vast amounts of power reliably, and having a path for the future for what to do with the leftover materials. And I'm not saying you slow down the development of liquid, but it's going to take you guys a little bit longer than you think.
It's going to take a while. Let me ask this, Rod. I mean, obviously, Charles and me are not, you know, Stephen Chu is not calling us up on the telephone or anything. I wish he was, but, you know, that's not happening. You know, neither is Westinghouse.
Well, but Hansen is.
Pardon me?
James Hansen's calling.
Well, James Hansen, he he and I have talked.
Okay.
What I would say, though, is, certainly nothing we're doing is inhibiting what is going forward on light water reactors. What I would wonder is, what is your view now, especially with the Yucca Mountain decision, on big utilities and their desire to take on the manufacture of large light water reactors? Do you feel like contrast that with maybe where we were a year ago?
I think the big utilities are moving forward. I think that there's a lot of big utilities who have basically recognize that the waste confidence rule that the NRC provided them years ago gives them all of the support they need if they want to build new nuclear plants. That said, there are also big utilities that are in service territories where the power demand is not growing very fast, and they have no desire at all for anybody to think it may be easy to build a new reactor plant in their service territory because they don't like the competition.
Okay, so, for instance, like the Zion plant up outside of Chicago.
Exactly, the one that I've written about several times.
Yeah.
Where I
think that's a low-growth area.
It's a low-growth area. There's the power. If Zion came online, there would be no need for natural gas turbines to be the price setter, which would lower the price of electricity throughout the year for all 17 other plants that Exelon sells electricity from. So, you know, that's the kind of thing that the businesses, you know, when John Rowe stands up and says, I don't think it's useful to build new nuclear power plants, the antis jump up and down and say, see, even John Rowe doesn't want to build anymore. He's got 17.
Yeah.
Well, of course he doesn't want to build anymore. He's already got 17.
Yeah, and that I can see what you're saying, because he is managing a distribution system that's in a fairly low-growth area. Now, where are the areas in the United States that are more the high-growth areas, like South Texas Project? Would that be an example?
Well, that's why John Rowe and Exelon are trying to buy NRG and are actually involved in a hostile takeover bid, which is almost unheard of in the electrical power industry. They have offered NRG, and NRG said, your offer is not good enough, first of all, and we're not interested. So leave us alone.
If Exelon got NRG, do you think they'd try to stymie the South Texas Project?
I don't think so. I think that Exelon loves the market in Texas because Texas has about 60% of the power is supplied by natural gas. So there's a lot more room to sell electricity at a much higher price in Texas than there is in the Midwest, upper Midwest of the U.S.
Yeah, power is expensive in Texas. We have baseload power being produced by natural gas.
Yep. Yeah, in Texas, well, it's not so bad right now because the price of natural gas has fallen considerably, but just a year, a half, 2 years ago, the average price of electricity in Texas was 12 or 14 cents per kilowatt hour at the wholesale level.
My goodness, that is,
you know,
that is
just
really
imagine high. Imagine operating an existing nuclear power plant and selling electricity in Texas. You're generating for 1.7 cents a kilowatt
Make
hour
money hand over fist.
And selling for 12. Run those numbers.
Yeah, it's good. It's real good.
That's why the wind people are getting into Texas is they're displacing natural gas produced electricity at night.
Right.
And they got very favorable economics for that.
Yeah, as long as they can get their power to market. I mean, the surprising thing about wind in Texas is there are actually some times of the day where the grid operators are getting paid by the wind guys to take their power.
About a third of the time.
You know, the price of electricity is actually negative.
Yeah.
Because
I first learned about that from Charles. It's really perverse how the subsidies have distorted the market. So,
well, yeah. this is West Texas wind, and they are not, they don't have a strong connection with the Texas grid.
Right.
So,
yeah, well, you know, electricity prices vary a lot more than most other commodities where, you know, you can very clearly define what the commodity is. So a kilowatt hour really is not a kilowatt hour in terms of value. And people just don't seem to understand that. You know, a kilowatt hour that's available to me in the middle of the night, you know, at the behest of the wind is simply not as valuable as a kilowatt hour that is there exactly when I turn on the switch, you know, in the middle of the day. And that's one of the fallacies in the the economic arguments from folks like Amory Lovins and other, you know, people who say, well, you should use the cheapest kilowatts first. Well, okay. You know, it's like seat hours.
Yeah.
Seat hours at a football stadium, you know. If my seat hour is just happens to correspond with the Super Bowl, it's far more valuable than my seat hour if I'm, you know, got sometime in mid-March in Chicago's football stadium.
Yeah, the more I've learned about Amory Lovins, the more I wonder how has this guy gotten the attention he has. I mean, it must just be a willful desire not to understand the realities of what he's talking about.
Who published his first articles?
I don't know. And the irony is,
Friends of the Earth. He was very big in with the environmentalist movement early, with the Club of Rome movement.
And I didn't mean to get off on Amory Lovins, because I know we'll talk all night about Amory Lovins.
But I was just going to say
there are people I know who I respect a great deal, very intelligent people and accomplished people, who think that Amory is just a real visionary and that he's straight on. And I just think, my goodness, you know, I know you're not a dummy, so what's the deal?
I've been writing, doing some work on green buildings, and he made these astonishing statements that he put his home, which was also the Rocky Mountain Institute office, on green energy, and got a payback in 10 months. All his investment was returned within 10 months from the savings. And you know that's just
bull.
Certainly doesn't sync up with my personal investigations with what it would take to buy solar panels for my home and have a reasonable payback time. When I've run the numbers on very pro-solar websites, the typical payback for me is on the order of 20 to 30 years, and that's even with fairly generous subsidies. And I think to myself, my goodness, I don't really think the panels are going to last that long.
Yeah. Well, you know,
can I tell you guys a story?
Go ahead.
You might get a kick out of this. The other day, I was in the District of Columbia, and I was on my way to the metro. And there was a young man there, and he said, can I talk to you about green energy? And my colleague was walking on trying to make it to the metro. And I stopped, and I walked back, and I said, yes, let's talk about that. And he said, oh, good. And he takes out his clipboard, and he was probably in his early 20s and had a scruffy beard and scruffy hair and just kind of looked like you would expect, you know, somebody who was a little more on the eco side to look. And he said, oh, good, you want to talk about clean energy? I said, yeah, in fact, that's the whole reason I'm here, is I've been talking to some people about clean energy. And he said, oh, that's interesting. Well, what have you been talking to them about? And I said, well, I've been talking to them about thorium. He said, well, what's thorium? I said, well, it's a couple of spots below uranium on the periodic table. And then he furrows his brow and he says, well, is it radioactive? I said, yes, it is radioactive. And he's like, oh. He said, well, what's the half-life? I said, well, it's got a 14 billion year half-life. It's got about the same half-life as the universe is old so far. And he goes, well, that's a long time to wait for the energy to come out. And I said, well, that's not how we get energy out of things like uranium and thorium. We fission them, we split them, and we can get the energy out much more quickly than waiting for them to decay. He goes, oh, well, isn't fission what's used in nuclear bombs? I said, yes, fission is the same process that is also used in nuclear weapons, but nuclear weapons, you know, one of the reasons thorium has traditionally been ignored is because of it's not applicable for nuclear weapons for a number of reasons. And he goes, I was realizing that he didn't understand even the most basic principles of how nuclear energy worked, the idea of fission, the idea of releasing energy through a fission reaction, you know, how that worked. And, you know, I'm sure he was very intelligent about maybe wind energy or solar or something like that, but it was disappointing to me to realize that this very, you know, engaged and excited young man who was obviously there, you know, spending a lot of time trying to talk to people, didn't understand how nuclear energy worked. And furthermore, as I looked around that day, it was the air was still, it was cold, there was a thick green-gray goop hanging over Washington that day, and I thought to myself, my goodness, there's not a watt of wind or solar power to be made today. You know, it's just it's a terrible day for those options. But I was kind of rebaselined about what many people may be thinking about nuclear power by my interaction with this young man.
I've had almost exactly the same experience. I was coming out of a Heritage Foundation-sponsored talk up near Capitol Hill, and I was approached by some Greenpeace canvassers on a day just like you described, except for I was under an umbrella because it was actually raining. But there was no wind. It was just barely warm enough for it to be rain rather than snow. And the man was trying to convince me that wind and solar was going to be the savior. And I said, well, I'm kind of a skeptic because I'm looking around. I'm saying it's pretty darn cold and windless day today. What's going to provide us power?
Yeah, you want to say, are we going to shut the city down today? Are we not going to go to work?
Well, he said, we'll just store it in batteries. And I said, well, do you have a cell phone? How long can you talk on your cell phone before the battery dies? How long can you run your car on the battery, you know?
Oh, man.
What's going on? Where's your questioning attitude?
You know.
Your critical thinking skills.
I wish I would have thought
exactly,
of that one. Later on.
Exactly. You know, one of the things I looked at when I started investigating how we were going to power the post-carbon world was, if we're going to have renewables, how are we going to store the electricity? And the batteries are just extremely expensive if you're going to do mass battery storage.
Yeah.
And I'm in a profession where, you know, energy storage is important, even on a nuclear submarine. You like to be able to have some sort of emergency power system.
Right.
You know, we've been looking at energy storage for a very long time.
At least 100 years in the terms.
For submarines, for 100 years. But, as a human species, we have always been interested in storing energy.
Right.
You know, one of the things I'm really... it bothers me, again, with this the critical thinking skills of people when they say, you know, even the President of the United States today, when he was talking about he's giving the introduction before he talked about, you know, his proposal for getting rid of nuclear weapons, he said, you know, we'll use new energy sources like the wind and the sun. And I said, new? Come on.
Yeah, there's nothing new about those. There's some of the oldest.
There's nothing new about the wind and the sun. It's been around a long time, you know, and... very smart people over thousands of years who said, you know, there is some energy in the wind and the sun, but it's just not here when I need it.
And it's not that much. You know,
it's not that much, and I have to have great big things to collect it.
On the very same trip up to D.C., I was riding on the Metro, and you're sitting on the Metro, and they have these advertisements, you know, occasionally inside the Metro cars. And there was a picture of a couple of guys standing on top of one of these really big wind turbines. And the tagline on the thing said, can we produce jobs out of thin air? And underneath it, it said, yes, all in capitals, with wind energy in lowercase, we can, all in capitals. And being as I was on the Metro and had a little bit of time, I said, I looked and I was like, yes, with wind energy, we can. Yes, with wind energy, we can. Yes, we can. Oh, aha, ding, ding, ding. I get it. I see what the target audience is. And it was obviously a wind energy campaign aimed squarely at the Obama administration, you know, trying to borrow some of the language that they had used during the campaign to say that wind energy was going to be a mechanism of jobs creation that would, you know, satisfy goals of the administration. And I, you know, having studied wind energy a little bit, had to think, yes, you can spend large amounts of, you know, federal money to buy wind turbines. Will they be economically advantageous? No, I don't think so. In fact, I think they will be a net drain on the economy to do that.
And besides that, once you build a wind turbine, how many jobs does it really support?
Well, there's the firemen that have to get out there to try to put out the fires.
They just let it burn because most places don't have a
450-foot
tall ladder.
They don't have, not just that, they don't have the pressure in the lines to make it up that far. That's why they don't have an active fire suppression system built into the wind turbine itself. It's a real interesting technology when you start getting into it to realize that this is a system that is built around very, very low power density. I mean, I'm looking at this gearbox and this generator on this 2-megawatt turbine, and I'm looking at it, and I can't help in my mind but contrast it with my experience at the Watts Bar nuclear power plant, where I stood in front of a generator that was not much bigger. It was probably fit in my garage. Maybe squeeze a little. And that generator, I'm standing there, and the representative TVA is telling me, this generator is essentially running the city of Knoxville right now. You're standing in front of it. Now, of course, there's a turbine connected to the generator, and there's a steam supply connected to the turbine, and there's a reactor connected to the steam supply. But I'm standing there in front of this generator, I'm thinking, my goodness, I'm standing in front of a machine that is running a city. And I tell you, that generator was smaller than this gearbox on this 2-megawatt wind turbine, which was producing a tiny fraction of what this reactor was, you know, and it's the kind of experience you don't soon forget, to stand in front of a machine that's running a city. It's just, wow, it's amazing. And that's what nuclear offers, is energy density and energy reliability. And, you know, give the people what they want. Give them wind turbines and solar and watch the cities go dark on days like that day. And it won't be long before people are saying, we want reliable energy. Give it to us.
Right. And you know, I've been using the term reliable energy a lot, because I think that the industry has kind of missed the boat by continuing to say, well, it's baseload energy. I don't think most of the public really understands that technical term. But, man, do they understand reliable energy.
They understand that
they want electricity, that when they flip the switch, it will be there. It will turn the light on. It will not cause their computer to go ooh, 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 as the wind varies in intensity.
And that's one of the things I've been talking about, is load following and mid-load energy and peak-load energy. Mm-hmm. And we can supply it all.
Well, fission is a very responsive phenomena. You know, when you have a reactor that has a negative temperature coefficient of reactivity, it has the ability to change power levels very quickly, as long as it's not too darn big.
Yeah, and that's a remarkable thing to understand.
When you make it really big, you end up with a lot of thermal inertia problems.
Right.
That have nothing to do with the fact it's nuclear. It's just because it's big.
Yeah.
And that's why. One of the reasons why I like the idea of small reactors, if you want a lot of power, you just couple as many small reactors as it takes to produce the power you want.
Yep.
And since you can mass produce them, you can build them cheaply.
Speaking of small reactors, I think I mentioned to you guys, I don't know if you had a chance to read it, apparently, there was a meeting in D.C. recently where the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has essentially thrown up their hands and say, you know, we just don't have the resources to figure out how to review and license small reactors, and we really need the DOE to step in and you know, take that mission from us. Because
I'm not sure how much more the DOE knows about it than the NRC does.
But here's the key. The reason the NRC says they can't build that capability is the NRC believes fully that they are funded almost 100% by existing licensees, by the utilities, and that they don't want to take money from those licensees and the services they're providing to those licensees to go and spend it on something new and different.
Mm.
And that's the way you can thank the Reagan administration for setting up the funding for the NRC, so that instead of it serving the needs of the people, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission believes that they have to serve the needs of the utilities that pay the fees.
Or feed off the utilities that pay the fees, I'm not sure.
Well, they don't get, the NRC doesn't get its money directly from the utilities. The utilities pay the Treasury, the NRC has to put in a budget submission just like any other agency and get their money out of the Treasury. But what that means is that the utilities, the companies that have existing generation today, are the ones who get the kibosh on new technologies. That would be like IBM being able to say, you know, you can't let those mini computers and those personal computers come into the business because you got to serve our needs first.
Oh, you're absolutely right. I mean, I see the construction that leads to the problem that we face, which is we want the NRC to give new ideas a fair shake. And from what you're saying, if they really look at it that way, then I can see why they have the problems that they do, you know, considering this. And it's an interesting topic. I'd love to go into it. I actually need to run, though.
Okay.
But it's been a pleasure talking to you, gentlemen, tonight.
It's a pleasure talking to both of you, and I'll go ahead and hang up for now. Everybody who listened, hope you enjoyed it, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Take care. Good night.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. The way is the Adams way.
And remember, that's not a vanity Adams way. That's the ATOMS way, the Adams way. Adams for peace. Let's hear it for Adams for peace. Take care.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.